We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons, and welcome to Focus 580. It's my great pleasure today to have as our guest for the hour, author and biologist Bill Strever, who will discuss his new book of nonfiction, Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places, published by Little Brown this past July. Bill Strever is a biologist who lives in Alaska in the Anchorage area, and he chairs the North Slope Science Initiative Science Technology Advisory Panel and serves on many other committees. A biologist, he lives with his son and fiancée in Anchorage, where he hikes, bikes, scuba dives, and cross-country skis as often as the weather allows. With the temperatures dipping this week in central Illinois, or they were at the beginning of the week, certainly a place that experiences some very cold weather. I mean, we even have ice fog here. This seems like the perfect topic today. New York Times, in its lead review from July 26, said that, quote, cold is a love song to science and scientists, to Earth and everything that lives in and flies over in tunnels underneath it. It's impossible to read this book and fully realize that our planet must be protected. I wrote in my own modest review in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that Mr. Strever writes eloquently in an appealing, informational essayist style similar to that of other cold weather authors, such as Barry Lopez, who wrote Arctic Dreams, and Gretel Ehrlich, who wrote This Cold Heaven and The Future of Ice. Our phone numbers, dear listeners, are 333-9455, and if you're out of the area, 1-800-222-9455. Let me introduce Mr. Strever by reading a brief passage from his book, Cold. In the Northern Hemisphere, half the land is covered with snow, and a third of the ocean is frozen. We are in the midst of a warm spell. We are worried about global warming, but the fact remains that even in the summer, whole regions remain covered with snow and ice. Bill Strever, welcome to Focus 580.
Thanks, Stephen. Really glad to be able to talk to you guys.
That's great. It's a balmy 58 degrees here, Bill, in Urbana. What's the temperature in Anchorage today?
I think it's probably, you know, it varies a lot around the city, but I think it's probably around 40. We're not quite down to freezing, and we had a little rain last night and kind of a overcast. Sort of one of those chilly autumn days. Winter's coming. There's snow in the mountains.
Do you consider the temperature today cold?
No, not at all. Okay. Still driving the convertible.
Okay.
Still have another month or so with the convertible top down, so this is not too bad.
In fact, what is your definition of cold?
Well, I guess, you know, you can define cold lots of different ways, or I can define cold lots of different ways with technical definitions and things, but I think you're asking more about what do I personally think of as cold, and, mm-hmm. and I guess to me it depends on two things. First, am I wet or am I dry? Because on a day like today when it's kind of moist outside, and if I went for a run, and as I probably will later, I like to run on the trails here around Anchorage, and if I go for a run and I'm damp from the rain, I'll probably consider today to be a little bit cold, at least for the first 5 minutes of the run. But the other thing is, how am I dressed? Am I dressed well or not? And, you know, and it, almost any kind of jacket or something is fine at 40 above, but at 40 below, with the right clothes, I don't necessarily consider that to be terribly cold. With the right clothes and maybe not being outside too long and no wind, it's not terribly cold at 40 below.
Your book gave me a new appreciation for cold weather, and I don't mind cold weather as much as some people. But I've always wondered why 40 degrees in late September feels cold, but 40 degrees in February feels warm. Is this psychological or biological?
Yeah, or is it both, right? So I think, you know, human beings do go through a little bit of sort of cold hardening. And, we usually talk about cold hardening in association with plants and things like that. But mammals and other animals also go through cold hardening before winter, and humans, to some small degree, go through cold hardening. So some of it's that your biology is changing a little bit, and there's been some studies on that. But I think some of it's psychological and some is behavioral. So in early fall, most of us are not very good about systematically changing out our wardrobe. But by spring, you know, we've gone through the winter, and by the end of the winter, we've changed what we're wearing. I think we're a lot better about systematically changing out our wardrobe on that first sunny day of spring or summer when we all break out the T-shirts and shorts, right? But when winter hits, we're much more likely just to put on cotton pants and maybe a sweatshirt, and it's later that we get out the wool sweaters and things of that nature.
I remember being on Kodiak Island and being extremely cold in March. That was one of the colder places I've been. But what do we need to understand about cold weather that maybe led you to write this book?
Oh, well, all kinds of things. It's such a rich and broad topic. So there's lots and lots of things that are out there that I think enrich people's lives by thinking about these things. So, all of us have experienced cold to one degree or another. Even people that live in the tropics and they walk into an air-conditioned room and they experience cold and they say, it's cold. But they most people, I don't think, give it much thought beyond that. They don't think about things like, how did they air condition this room, or why is it so much colder, say, in northern Alaska than it is in, say, Florida, or what's going on with the sea ice, and what does it mean that the average temperatures are changing by certainly by a few degrees, if not more. What is the cultural impact of cold through history? How has it affected things like wars and food, and the list goes on and on and on. So just a really broad topic, and there's so much to learn and so much to see that when I started writing cold and started doing the research and kind of focusing on it as a topic, I was amazed as my own horizon sort of broadened around the topic. And even now, every day every time I do an interview like this one, I'll learn something more about cold from one of your callers.
Mm-hmm. I was fascinated to learn we are living in an ice age.
Yeah, and a lot of people would cringe when I say that because, of course, global warming and climate change are a very hot political issue, and no doubt the planet is getting warmer, but also no doubt we still have ice caps on both poles. Greenland is still, for the moment anyway, covered in ice. There's still lots of alpine glaciers around. And wintertime in the northern hemisphere, a large part of the ground turns white, as you guys know, down in your part of the country. So arguably, we still are in an ice age, and it depends a lot on how you define things. But the Pleistocene, which many people consider to be the period of the Great Ice Age, was really a period of four major glaciations, and periods in between those glacial periods, such as the one we're in now, the interglacials, when it seemed to be somewhat warmer, and we cycled back and forth, and in the absence of all the gases we've pumped into the atmosphere, it's quite possible that we would be headed back toward a glacial period. And in fact, in the 1970s, when I was a boy, the word was indeed that we were headed back into another ice age. And of course, that was before the scientific community and the environmental community had as good an appreciation as we do now of the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Fairbanks comes across as a wonderful test, if you will, a cold city case study, you could say. What's it like for residents in Fairbanks, and how do they cope with the extreme cold weather? I was surprised to learn that bikes are very useful in the wintertime.
Yeah, Fairbanks is a great town. The people there are, let's say, hardy and independent might be the best way to describe them. They're, Fairbanks is our flagship university town in Alaska, so the University of Alaska in Fairbanks is one of the highlights of the city, and it's also a mining community and a military community. So you have all these communities that kind of come together, and I think there's probably about 50,000 people, so it's not a big city by most standards in the U.S., but by Alaska standards, it's our second biggest city. And how do people cope? I think most people would say that the cold is not so bad. It's the darkness that really bothers them, the wintertime darkness. And, darkness does play with your mind quite a bit. Day after day of wintertime darkness can change your outlook on life. So coping with the cold, it's not so much an issue, especially because the wind doesn't blow so badly there. So they might have days of or even weeks of 40 below and even colder. And it's kind of annoying, but you dress for it and you adapt your lifestyle so that maybe you're not as dependent on a 1970 vintage car that barely runs, because that's not going to serve you very well in that climate. But people adjust, they cope.
We're talking
with
We're talking with Bill Strever, author of Cold. Our phone numbers are 333-9455. If you're out of the area, 1-800-222-9455. Just back to Fairbanks for a second. Now, windshields crack easily. The houses settle. What are some of the other effects?
The houses settling is an interesting one, and that's, of course, not so much because of one day of cold weather or 2 days of cold weather. That's because much of Fairbanks is sitting on top of shallow permafrost. So permafrost is ground that's permanently frozen, or I guess, you know, the technical definition is that it doesn't come, the ground that doesn't come above 0 degrees C or 32 Fahrenheit for more than 2 years at a time is considered to be permafrost. And it might be just soil, it might be gravel and rock, but as often as not, there's quite a lot of frozen water mixed in with the frozen ground. And so you build a house on top of that frozen ground, on top of that shallow permafrost, and your house looks like it's doing fine, looks like very solid ground, except you turn on your heater, and that heat leaks down into the ground and starts to melt that ground ice. And if there is very much frozen water or ice in the ground, and it melts, it flows away, and what was solid ground starts to collapse. So it's not too uncommon in places like Fairbanks to see houses that are slumped, and they're usually slumped in the middle, so that the outer edge of the house, where it's coolest, are highest, and the middle of the house is lowest, or you'll see houses that have an unheated attached garage, and the garage would be higher than the rest of the house, for example. So a real problem for homeowners if that does happen to their homes.
Can you define hibernation, and why is it that we humans can't hibernate? It would be kind of nice in some of these cold weather months to just go to sleep for a while.
Well, that's right. There's all kinds of tricks that animals have that some animals have that humans don't have, and hibernation is one of them. And, you know, of course, a lot of people, when it starts to get dark out, they do sleep more, but that's a long, long way from hibernation. And I guess, you know, one thing to think about is that hibernation does come in different degrees or different varieties. So you have animals like bears, and at least in some schools nowadays, they teach kids that bears don't really hibernate. And I would disagree with that. I would say that it really depends on your definition of hibernation. And it would be right to say that bears don't go into a deep, deep hibernation the way some other animals do. But in fact, they do go to sleep for the winter, and in some bears and at some latitudes, because even within a species, it varies depending on how far north and probably depending on how high you are in the mountains as well, how their physiology changes. So things like their heart rates may drop to as low as 10 beats a minute or maybe even lower, and they can reprocess nitrogenous waste. So, you know, normally they would have to urinate. Humans would have to urinate, bears would have to urinate, but bears have the trick of being able to reprocess those wastes for weeks or months at a time so they don't have to urinate. And the same with calcium in their bones. They can reprocess their calcium. So I would argue that bears really are hibernating, even though they're not hibernating as deeply as, say, a ground squirrel. And humans have almost no ability this way. I mean, sure, we get sleepy in the winter, and we like to eat more in the winter probably, and things like that. But we're a long way from hibernating, even to the degree of a bear with a shallow hibernation. And then if you compare that further to the animal that I think of as the sort of king of hibernators or the champion hibernator is the Arctic ground squirrel. And it's, to people in your part of the country, it would probably look more like a prairie dog than like a squirrel. It has a tendency to stand up on its hind legs and look around, and it's got a short tail, and they're sort of long and chubby, and they're bigger than most gray squirrels. But the Arctic ground squirrel, which is very common in the mountains in this part of Alaska, and as you move north, it becomes common at sea level. It goes into a very, very, very deep hibernation, and its body temperature starts to drop, and its body temperature drops all the way to freezing, and then actually keeps dropping below freezing to a level at which its blood would actually freeze. So its blood becomes what's called supercooled. It's still liquid, but it could freeze if there was a nucleation site, if something was there to trigger the freezing. So it gets down to that temperature around, say, 31 and a half degrees or 31 degrees Fahrenheit, and it starts to do what's called non-shivering thermogenesis. There's a big technical word for you, non-shivering thermogenesis, where it maintains that body temperature at around 31 degrees or so, but not by shivering. And then it'll do that for weeks at a time, so it won't allow itself to get any colder, because if it did get colder, its blood actually would freeze, and that would kill the animal. So it just kind of hovers right around 31. And then every once in a while, several times through the winter, it will start to shiver, and it'll break out of hibernation by shivering. It'll warm up. It doesn't actually wake up. It'll warm up by shivering, and its brain waves will go into kind of a dream pattern, and it appears to start to dream. So who knows what ground squirrels dream about, but it'll dream like that for around a day, and then its body will just start to cool off again. It'll stop shivering, and its body will start to cool off again, and down it goes back to somewhere right below 32 degrees for another cycle. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the ground squirrel, if that's not interesting enough, but one of the other interesting things is that it really spends most of its life in this this semi-frozen state where if you picked one up and you looked at it, listened for a heart rate, and didn't listen very closely and things like that, you would assume it was dead for many practical purposes. It doesn't seem very lively. Even its brain waves are in a pattern that suggests nobody's home here until it shivers and goes into that dream state.
But, of course, not just mammals hibernate. I was fascinated to learn about the porwil and what's called the sleeping one.
That's right. The Hopi, in the Hopi language, Hopi Indian language, it would translate as the sleeping one, and it's a bird. To most people, it would look, you know, not a very astonishing looking bird, and it is, as far as I know, the only bird that's known to go into a state of hibernation. And in that state of hibernation, the bird can be handled, looked at. You can listen to its for breathing and those kinds of things, and it's in a very deep state of hibernation, so it's difficult to detect a heartbeat or breathing. Put the bird back, come back later, and the bird later, as in weeks later when the hibernation breaks, and the bird wakes up and flies away and goes on about its life. Very unusual strategy for a bird.
In other birds, I was surprised to hear that at least 100 species of North American birds do not migrate. I mean, they don't fly away for the winter. They tough it out. How do they survive the elements?
Well, yeah, that's right. And you know, I like to think, and I think a lot of people that work on cold region or winter ecology like to think of animals as either migrators. So birds are the most common example given for migrators. Birds that fly, in the case of the Arctic tern, as far as from the pack ice in the Beaufort Sea up in the Arctic Ocean, and fly south for the winter as far as Antarctica. So they go pole to pole twice each year, right, basically flying the circumference of the Earth one time each year. So those are migrators, and then there's the hibernators that we already talked about. And then there's these other animals, including some birds, that are tolerators. So they tough it out through the winter. And how do birds do that? Well, different birds have different strategies, but one fairly obvious key is that they have to continue to feed through the winter. So they have to take in calories to replace all those calories that they're losing to the outside world. Another strategy for the ptarmigan, which Alaska's state bird is the ptarmigan, and it looks like a white grouse, if that means anything to you. Mm-hmm. It looks sort of like a white grouse. And they tend to be ground birds. They spend a lot of time on the ground and maybe do short flights. They can fly, but just short flights. But in the winter, they'll dig tunnels in the snow, and they spend a lot of time in actual tunnels. They also spend a lot of time hunkered down in depressions in the snow, so that if you're out skiing in the backcountry or snowshoeing, you'll often flush these birds without realizing you're on top of one, and all of a sudden it flies up from almost from between your skis and gives you a sun startle, but also a very pretty sight to see these almost pure white birds flying across the snow.
I've seen them in above timberline in Colorado, but during the summer when they're not white. And you're right, they look like grouse.
That's right, yeah.
And then there's the wood frog, and this is a fascinating story. I mean, it actually has ice in its veins. The only other creature I've heard has ice in its veins is Michael Jordan when he was playing basketball. Can you talk about the wood frog?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would call it Jordan to a wood frog. He might take exception to that. Yeah. There's, I think in the book I said there were four species of frogs, including the wood frog, that freeze in the winter, and I understand that that two more have been are now known to freeze in the winter, and yeah, their body fluids freeze, but it's not the fluids inside their cells, and this is a trick that they share with plants. They push the fluids out from inside of their cells, the water out from inside of their cells, so that the fluids that are inside their cells become more and more salty, more and more concentrated, dissolved material, so it becomes harder and harder to freeze inside of the cell, but the liquids in between the cells do freeze, and the wood frog becomes sort of a frogsicle. It freezes, and you can pick it up. It looks frozen. It is frozen.
Hmm.
And then it hops away in the spring.
Is winter ecology an evolving research area right now? I mean, it seems like some of the discoveries that you pointed out in your book are fairly new.
Yeah, you know, I think people have been interested in it for a long time, but like many fields of science, new things are found all the time. I'm not sure if I would say that it's that the rate of discovery is increasing or not. There are certainly some people that are very active. Brian Barnes in Fairbanks is very, very active with animals like wood frogs and ground squirrels and even with insects that freeze and hibernate in different ways. So there are people out there that are building very interesting careers and publishing great papers and learning new things about hibernation. But I'm not sure that I would say that the field is sort of a growth area.
Mm-hmm. You've got some fascinating stories throughout the book. Most of them do not have happy endings, I might add. Could you tell us a little bit about the school children's blizzard of 1888?
Yeah, the children's blizzard of 1888. Laskin wrote a book called The Children's Blizzard or The School Children's Blizzard, and a great and very detailed account of what happened in that blizzard. But basically, people woke up in the morning, and it seemed like it was going to be an unseasonably pleasant day, and they sent their kids in the prairie. They sent their kids off to school, and their kids would walk, you know, sort of Little House on the Prairie scenes where they would walk across a mile or 2 miles or whatever to school, and they went off to school, and they weren't as well equipped as they normally would be. And this blizzard came in seemingly out of nowhere and dropped the temperatures very, very abruptly and also reduced visibility to zero with blowing snow, so you really couldn't tell where you were. And sadly, quite a few people, quite a few children and some adults decided to try to make their way home before conditions got too bad and wound up trapped in this blizzard and freezing to death. Lots and lots of immediate deaths from hypothermia, or what some people call exposure, so their body temperature lowering to a point where they die and then they freeze, or their bodies can freeze, and other people suffering from severe frostbite, so they have tissue that freezes even though their core temperature doesn't get so low that it kills them. The tissue, the fingers, ears, nose, feet freeze, and so those extremities die, and many people died from the infections that followed from frostbite.
Yeah, I think you said 22,000 people perished, and many of them boys and girls, and one 17-year-old girl died standing up. We're talking with Bill Strever, author of Cold. Our phone numbers are 333-9455, out of the area, 800-222-9455. We have a caller from Lovington. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, morning.
Morning.
This is... When I first heard this subject, I thought, boy, that's going to be interesting. And it turns out it has been very interesting. I think maybe about every time I thought of something to ask, you come up with a pretty good story. My question I had this morning was, what makes people decide to settle where they are? Obviously, you like Anchorage, and this is as far north as I think people should ever come. So I just wondered whether you've done any research on that.
Yeah, well, you know, no, I haven't. I would say for Americans, most Americans settle in places these days because of jobs and maybe to a smaller extent because of personal relationships or family. But don't tell anybody, but Alaska is just an incredible place to live. So, and I would guess that our climate in many ways is here in Anchorage, Alaska, it may be more mild than where you are. Our winter, we're close enough to the ocean that our winters are fairly mild. We very seldom go colder than minus 10 or minus 15 or so. So it's not too bad here in Anchorage. And our summers are cool. We don't get the kind of heat that people get down around Chicago in the summer. So we're very comfortable just touching 70 a couple of times a year. It's a great climate and got mountains and super people that live in the area, lots of people from all over the country. So anyway, it's a great place to live. But why do people settle where they settle? Who knows? And who knows why, for example, the Inupiat people wandered north, what many Americans call the Eskimo, wandered north along the coast some long, long time ago, and it's argued how long ago it was, but certainly more than 10,000 and maybe 20 or 30,000 years ago, these people were living, first the Thole people and later the Inupiat people, living in the far north of Alaska, where conditions are, by the standards of mere mortals, are absolutely brutal, and yet these people chose to live there. Why did they choose to live there? Well, you could argue they were following game, or they were driven there by competing groups of people for, you know, territoriality, this sort of thing. Who knows? But they do live there, and even though someone from Florida or more temperate climates might find it absolutely appalling that someone would choose to live in a place like Barrow, Alaska, the people that live in Barrow love it there and wouldn't trade it, would never trade it for Florida. They would find that appallingly hot.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller from Atlanta, Illinois, that is. Go ahead, caller.
Good morning, gentlemen, or good afternoon. What an interesting conversation. I tuned in a little bit late, so hopefully I'm not repeating what somebody else asked, but about late 1940s or early 1950s, Ford Times, of all places, had an article about the Northeast that old-timers were relating the fact that when they were children, this would have probably been back in the 1800s, that if there was older people in the family at that time, at a certain point in time in the winter, they would take the older people out in the snow because of the fact that the food supplies would probably be running a little bit low for the larger family unit, and they would actually bury the older people in the snow at that time in the winter when it was probably extremely cold, and then they would go back in the spring and retrieve them, and they would still be alive. And of all places, in Ford Times, is there any truth to any of those folklore stories?
Thank you, caller.
Seems unlikely. That would be, I mean, virtually impossible to believe something like that for humans.
But you do talk about this this movement to try to preserve people.
Sure, cryogenics. I'm not sure movement is the right word. cryogenics is the practice of freezing humans, and at least in the United States, they would have to be recently deceased humans. You could not do this while you were still alive voluntarily under U.S. law. But starting in the 1960s, there was a book published called The Prospect of Immortality, and it was a best-selling book, printed in many different languages, sold, I believe, millions of copies. And what the book proposed was that with what were then thought of as modern technologies, it would be possible to freeze humans, particularly humans that had succumbed to some disease, and freeze these humans, then thaw them out at some unknown time in the future when that disease was curable, and thaw them out and then cure their disease, and they would go on living. And the first person to do that was a psychologist named James Bedford, who lived in California, and he died of a form of cancer and had prearranged to, as soon as he died, had prearranged to have his body and his remains, he thought it was still his living body, processed in a way that they could be frozen, and he was frozen in liquid nitrogen and remains frozen today. There's been lots of people who have weighed in on this. There's lots of urban myths out there about this process, but it is real. It is possible to do it. There's more than one organization that would help you out if you're interested in that. One is called the Alcor Institute, and I believe it's based in California in the Southwest somewhere. And you can even set up life insurance policies to pay for the process. So if you believe this will work, it's a pretty inexpensive path toward immortality, about $150,000 to have your body cryogenically frozen and stored, presumably in perpetuity.
And I think Ted Williams went that route as well. The difference between frostbite and hypothermia, can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. And for many people, this would be very much intuitive, and for others, they maybe haven't thought about it. But hypothermia is the lowering of your core temperature. So our bodies are hovering up around 99 degrees Fahrenheit on a normal day, and they fluctuate a little bit if we're physically active or running a small fever, or if we're a little bit chilled, there's a little bit of fluctuation. But if our core temperature drops even just a few degrees, we become what's called hypothermic. Some people refer to exposure, and it's really kind of the same thing. But as our body temperature drops just a few degrees, we start to get symptoms, and of course, our body goes through a period of shivering, trying to maintain our nice warm temperature. But as we drop down to around 93, we start to get short-term amnesia. So you might forget where you might forget that you just took off your gloves, for example. And then around 91, we start to get apathetic. And down around 90 or so, and in the high 80s, we get to a place where survival just isn't going to happen unless somebody comes along and saves us. We're no longer capable of self-rescue at those temperatures, at those body temperatures. And frostbite is entirely different. Your core temperature can be warm and toasty, just fantastic, but the tips of your fingers or your ears or your nose or your toes could be freezing and much, much below 90 degrees. In fact, for true frostbite to occur, your extremities are freezing, so they're down around 32 degrees or even colder before they freeze, and they can freeze solid. Absolutely kills the tissues. There's lots going on there. One thing is that there's ice crystals forming, and those ice crystals are tearing membranes inside of your cells, so the organelles inside your cells are being torn open, as are the cell walls themselves. The other thing that happens is that as ice forms, it desiccates the cells around it. So an ice crystal starts to form, and it starts to suck water out of the cells around it and dehydrates those cells. So that's frostbite, is when a limb is actually frozen. And I think on one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movie, they're sailing around in some northern or southern latitudes with ice, and one of the pirates is very cold, and he breaks his finger off because it's frozen. It's a great but sort of comical scene.
Now, the last stage of hypothermia is fascinating to me. You talk about this sort of delirious act of undressing, what's called a paradoxical undressing. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, paradoxical undressing, I think it's seen mostly in people that are freezing to death fairly quickly. So oftentimes, for example, with Arctic explorers or polar explorers, people would succumb to a combination of freezing and starving. So as they were running out of food, they had fewer and fewer calories, and their bodies needed those calories to stay warm. So they would more or less slowly freeze to death, and they would start to have all kinds of problems with that. But with, say, for example, mountaineers who are out in extreme conditions, and they're becoming hypothermic because they're lost or they've fallen and they're injured or something like that, and they're freezing to death fairly quickly, even though they may still have quite a lot of body fat and whatnot left to burn. Their body can't burn that stuff quick enough to keep them warm, and they're freezing to death quickly. And sometimes when that happens, people get toward the final stages, and they start to feel, the survivors have described things like feeling a sudden flush of heat, and because of that, they rip off their hat and take off their scarf and even talk about difficulty breathing, so they rip off their clothes and paradoxical undressing their habit.
Is that done with perishing from heat as well?
I'm working on my new book, Heat.
It's a good segue.
Natural History, great segue, and I'll have to get back to you on that one. It does certainly seem believable that people that were dying from heat exposure might do that, but I think that some of the symptoms of heat exposure might leave you pretty incapacitated before you were ready to start ripping your clothes off.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about absolute zero. I mean, it's minus 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit. How is that determined, and what happens at that temperature?
Yeah, absolute zero. So when you think about temperature, in one dimension, temperature is basically molecular motion or molecular vibration. So it's movement of molecules, movement of atoms. And the quicker atoms are moving, the quicker molecules are moving about and vibrating, the warmer something is, and the slower they move, the colder something is. And at some point, there is no motion, so the motion has stopped, and that's the point of absolute zero. So it can't get any colder than that, because it's not as though moving things in reverse makes them colder. It doesn't work that way. They're either moving or they're not. And when they're not moving, there's no heat. There's no nothing to measure, so it's absolute zero, and that's, of course, refers to the Kelvin scale, which starts at the coldest possible temperature, zero, and goes up from there, and hence the name absolute zero. And as you said, it's about minus 460 Fahrenheit. But strange things happen at those very, very cold temperatures. So in the 1800s, people, scientists began in earnest to try to push the downward temperature envelope harder and harder. And they learned to do things like making liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, and eventually somebody even got down to liquid helium. But they realized fairly soon that as they approached absolute zero, it became much, much, much more difficult to remove heat. And it wasn't really until the 1990s that we got extremely close to absolute zero, and even today people are still pushing that envelope using very amazing technologies. But much earlier than that, Albert Einstein and another scientist named Bose developed a concept called the Bose-Einstein condensate. So they predicted that as one approached the temperature of absolute zero, a new state of matter would exist that they called the Bose-Einstein condensate. And that new state of matter would not be very similar at all to things that we experience in everyday life, like solids, liquids, and gases. It would be something different. And it wasn't until much, much later that was indeed confirmed as we approached those very, very cold temperatures.
Now, there was a price to pay for learning about this temperature. I understand there was I can think of one story you told of amputation of one lab assistant.
Well, that's right. Back in the 1800s, and even into the 1900s, I think, as people were pushing toward these very cold temperatures, they liked to. You have to remember this was a period of time that there was also a great romance around polar exploration, and polar explorers were the real heroes of the day. So people like Scott and Amundsen were thought of in the popular mind as real heroes, and these guys were, to my eye anyway, superhuman. These were amazing men. But these scientists working in their lab also felt that they were exploring the extremes of temperature, and they talked about themselves as explorers on the technological front as opposed to the geographical front. And they pushed hard. These were ambitious guys. These were smart guys. But they pushed hard, and they were using equipment that by today's standards would be considered pretty primitive stuff. And as you got in, as you move into lower temperatures, I think most people are aware that things like metal, most metals start to become very brittle as you get colder, even in temperatures that humans experience fairly routinely in some parts of the world, like minus 30, minus 40, metals become brittle. Wire, copper wire in particular, becomes very easy to break. So as these guys were going colder, they would have laboratory explosions of different kinds. And in one case, one particular scientist was asked to stop his work because of an explosion in a laboratory. And these kinds of stories were unfortunately not too uncommon. The safety ethic that sort of permeates scientific research today and industrial activities today was not what it was, or was not what it is back in the 1800s.
We're talking with Bill Strever, author of Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Our phone number is 333-9455, out of the area, 800-222-9455. Your last chapter deals with climate change, but it really differs from a lot of the things that we do read, which are more, I think, I don't want to say hysterical, but more emotional, let's put it that way. What do we need to know about global warming?
Yeah, well, I guess I think what you're talking about is normally if you pick up an article about climate change, it's either somebody who's almost preaching about how terrible climate change is and that it's obviously happening, or it's somebody who's arguing that this is a load of bunk and it's not going on, and mm-hmm. why are we changing our economy to deal with something that was just dreamed up by other people. But I think what every person, what every citizen should know about climate change, I guess there's two things, and one is scientific and the other is historical. So let's start with the history, because I'm a scientist, so history is more fun for me. So let's start with the history. And the history of climate change and of thinking about climate change is much older than I think most people realize. If you talk to the man on the street or the woman on the street about climate change, oftentimes they'll say, well, this is just something that somebody thought up in the 90s, or other people will say, well, no, it came about in the 80s or the 60s. And in fact, as far back as the middle of the 1800s, Fourier, who's a scientist who worked, he's well known for his Fourier transformations that are used to sort of torture engineers when they're in college that deal with signal processing and things like that. But he also worked on gases in the climate, and Fourier was the first person to recognize, and in his case to welcome, the fact that because of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because of water vapor in the atmosphere, the Earth was much warmer than it would otherwise be. So he recognized the importance of these gases as sort of a way to trap heat or to convert sunlight into heat and hold that heat in the Earth. He recognized it. He saw it. Later, there were other people. There was a person named Guy Callender in the 1930s who was actually a steam engineer. And he was one of the first people to say, wait a minute, the Earth is getting warmer. It's because of gases coming from industry. And eventually, he was sort of forgotten. People didn't believe it. And one of the things that was pointed out was that the oceans had remarkable capacity to absorb carbon dioxide from the world's smokestacks. And to some degree, that was true. But the problem was the rate at which the carbon dioxide was being produced was much, much quicker than the rate at which the oceans could absorb it. And also, at some point, the buffering capacity of the oceans are exhausted. And it took a person named Roger Revelle, an oceanographer working in the, I think, the late 1950s, to come along and point out to people that, well, wait a minute, we may still have a big problem here. And then it evolved from there. And, of course, today it is largely recognized that we have a big problem or could have a big problem. And as we recognize that, we are a free society that encourages differences of opinion, and not too surprisingly, there are lots of differences of opinion about what's going on out there and about how important it is. But on the science side, the easy thing to say about climate change is that in a closed system like an atmosphere, you add a whole bunch of carbon dioxide. It's just very simple physics. All else being equal, nothing else changes. Add a bunch of carbon dioxide to our atmosphere, you absolutely would expect it to get warmer. The trick is all else equal? And the answer to that, people try to make complicated mathematical models and different things like that. But at the end of the day, it's very, very difficult to predict the future. All else being equal, it is going to get warmer. Should we worry about it? Absolutely, we should worry about it. Are we absolutely going to get warmer? Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen 10 years from now, 15 years from now? Does that mean we're not going to worry about it? We all plan for our retirements, right? Well, hopefully. We all plan for our retirements, even though who knows if we're going to die in a bus crash tomorrow. You know, so we look at the best possible prediction in the future, and we kind of plan for those things. Science tells us add carbon dioxide and it'll get warmer.
Mm-hmm. I want to return to something Gretel Ehrlich said in her book, The Future of Ice, and you may or may not have read it, but she proposes this idea that someday winter may only last a day. And she also says, what would life be if winter disappears? Have you contemplated either of those ideas, or even do you even agree that winter may last only a day? It seems like a large statement.
Yeah, well, I should probably mean cold season will only last a day. You know? Mm-hmm. Being a scientist, you define winter by astronomical events. But anyway, I can't believe that any kind of foreseeable future for people that are around today, that's something you should spend any time at all worrying about. Even when we look at the pack ice, the ice in the Beaufort Sea, where I spend a reasonable amount of my time, that ice is not going to disappear in the winter. What we're worried about, what we're seeing, is really, really dramatic losses of summertime sea ice. And when I say dramatic losses, so far we've lost an area about twice the size of Texas of the summertime sea ice. So compared to the long-term average, which only goes back 20 or 30 years, but compared to that long-term average, the current extent of the sea ice is we've lost an area in the summer twice the size of Texas. So dramatic summertime sea ice loss. In the wintertime, though, the Beaufort Sea and the Arctic Ocean still more or less freezes. There's always been openings in the ice. That there's nothing new there. They're called polynyas. There's always been openings in the ice in the wintertime. But by and large, the sea ice does come back in the winter. And, in fact, right around now, we're starting to see the ocean start to refreeze. Mm-hmm. So I really don't think we'll get to a place where we have one true day of cold in these northern latitudes. Now, you could argue in some parts of the country, Miami, for example, you're already there.
Mm-hmm. I guess to follow that just a little bit, what do we lose, and I know you're a scientist, not a psychologist, but what do we lose psychologically from having cold weather, not having an absence of cold weather? That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, and I'm a scientist by profession, but a person, so we're all lots of different things, right? But mm-hmm. And I'm very bought into the romantic vision of the cold and a romantic valuing of variability in weather. So one of the things that I like most about northern climates is their variability, both season to season and day to day. I think both those things are important, and I think both those things shape the way people think. And for me, right now, I'm you know, starting to think about waxing my skis, getting ready for the snow, which could come. No, we usually have skiable snow by late October here, so just a few weeks away. That's a big thing to me, just like it's a big thing in the spring when the snow is starting to melt, and I'm starting to think of getting my getting out my mountain bike and you know, putting the skis and the snowshoes away. All those things are important to me, and I think the loss of that variability would be a real loss for some members of society. Of course, others there are others who would welcome that.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do Alaskans feel about cold?
Oh, you know, I think it's a mixed bag. There's plenty of people living in Alaska that pretty much hunker down for the winter. They inhabit houses, movie theaters, and shopping malls all winter long as much as possible. But I would say that the majority of Alaskans who are here as a lifestyle choice thrive in the cold. And in fact, I get an awful lot of emails and phone calls from people telling me how much they love the cold and, in fact, how much they hate the heat. And how could anybody ever live in a warm climate? They don't understand. And you can dress for the cold, but you can't dress for the heat, and all these things that people like to say. So I think the real Alaskans, quote-unquote, the Alaskans that are here by choice and aren't waiting for the day that they can move to Hawaii or Florida, these are people who love the cold and thrive in the cold. They often are into various kinds of winter sports. Snow machining is a big one up here, cross-country skiing or backcountry skiing. Et cetera, et cetera.
There are a lot of people still perish from the cold in Alaska, even with our new technology of clothing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, every year there are lots of cases of death from exposure. Much fewer cases of death from frostbite because frostbite nowadays with proper medical treatment, which includes amputation, but infection control. Most people would not die from frostbite, but still quite a few deaths every year from hypothermia. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but a percentage of those deaths are from people that are intoxicated and, in effect, they pass out in the cold and don't wake up before it's too late. And then other people, there's one person I mentioned in my book who was cutting his grass right around this time of year, and he was at a remote property on a riding lawnmower, and the lawnmower fell over on him and pinned him to the ground. It wasn't terribly cold, but by morning he had frozen to death. Mm. And other accidents often associated with hunting or outdoor sports where somebody becomes injured or wet, and those are two things that are not good. Injury that slows you down from moving and keeping your body temperature up and getting back to a warm place, or getting soaked and not having some way to get into dry clothes.
I want to return just for a second. We have a couple of minutes left to bears, bears hibernating. I thought it was a fascinating story to find out actually what the heartbeat of a bear was when it was hibernating, because that's not work for the faint of heart, I imagine.
I think you're talking about Lynn Rogers.
Right.
Quote, yeah, sure, he and many other bear biologists do spend time crawling into bear dens. I know of two instances here in Alaska, and I've never had this happen, but two instances of bear biologists who were working on polar bears who in one case fell into a den and in another case thought the den was unoccupied and crawled into the den and realized as he was halfway in that he could hear breathing and made a rapid exit. So, yeah, those things happen, and they can be pretty exciting. Better than a cup of coffee, I guess, right?
So the one biologist fell through a hole onto a bear, almost its ear to its chest, right?
Well, I think in the case of Lynn Rogers, that's probably what you're thinking of. Mm-hmm. He was actually in working on the bear that was hibernating, and this is definitely not for the faint of heart, because bears are relatively light hibernators, but if a bear is in hibernation, you could, in theory, crawl into the den, which I think was what Lynn was doing, and not only listen to the heart rate, but even get various samples, maybe up to and including blood samples, without waking the animal up. But occasionally the animal will wake up, and then you've got a quick exit on your hands. As far as I know, all the stories I've ever heard of biologists working on bears, the bears were as surprised and horrified to find a human there as the humans were surprised and horrified to find an awake bear. So each party went their own way. It didn't lead to an immediate mauling.
I imagine.
And, you know, I think in general, I mean, I live in Alaska and I have bear encounters every year, and I think in general people have a fear of bears, which is probably very healthy because they are potentially dangerous animals. But usually bears either want to mind their own business and ignore you, or they want to run and avoid you. It's very rare that a bear would go out of its way, very, very rare that a bear would go out of its way to attack a human, and somewhat rare that a bear would even stand its ground and defend itself. Under the right circumstances, it certainly does that, but the vast majority of encounters, even in dens, the bear, you know, bears don't like humans. They know humans are problems.
Well, we've just spent an hour with Bill Strever, author of Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. He said he's also working on a book on heat. Will it be named Heat also?
It will. Well, to the extent that the author controls the title,
yeah,
it'll be called Heat, A Natural and Unnatural History.
Of course, Bill Buford has a book called Heat as well about cooking. But thank you, Bill, and best of luck with this book and the book in the future. The book we talked about today is Cold, and it's an excellent read. I highly recommend it. It's published by Little Brown Books. And thank you again. That's Focus 580 for today. Thanks for listening, and please stay tuned for the afternoon magazine.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the university's Center for Business and Public Policy, presenting, in conjunction with the Academy on Capitalism and Limited Government, Are We Regulating Capitalism Out of Existence? On Thursday, October 1st at 1:30 p.m. in the Illini Union. Keynote speaker Stephen Moore will discuss this topic with a multidisciplinary panel of scholars.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
And it's 2 minutes before 12 noon here on WILL AM 580 and time for the afternoon magazine. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in for Celeste Quinn today, and Jay Pierce will actually be doing the show at the 1 o'clock hour. He'll have an in-depth interview coming up during that hour. Right now, let's take a look at how the commodity markets are doing. And at the moment, we're seeing another mixed bag with the wheat market down, but the soybeans generally up. The corn is pretty much flat at the moment. The December wheat contract in Kansas City is down 4.25 cents at 464.25 a bushel. March at 480.5, down 4.25. And December wheat in Chicago is down 3.5 cents at 444. The March contract at 463.75, that's down 3.5 cents. May wheat at 477 on the Board of Trade, down 4. Unchanged all around for corn at this very moment. December is standing at 341, March at 354, May at 363 a bushel, July at 371. All of those contracts right now are unchanged. The September of next year is up 2 at 381.25. Energy stocks look like this, contracts look like this. The November crude oil is up a healthy $2.75 a barrel right now at $69.46. October RBOB gasoline is at $171.02. That's up 8.4 cents at the moment. Now onto the bean complex. The November contract is at $9.25.5. That's up 8.5 cents. January at $9.31.75, up 9.25 cents. And the March contract at $9.31.5, up 9. May beans are at $9.28.25, up 10.5 cents. July of next year, $9.28, up 9.25. October bean meal is at $2.87.40, down 60. Bean oil for October at $34.07, up 60. Live cattle for October in the livestock segment is at 85.50, 100 weight. That's down 15. Feeder cattle are up 20 right now at 96 even for October. October lean hogs at $50 even, down 20.